In the United States, we felt that it was a public good to digitize the nation's health infrastructure. Many countries around the world have since shared that philosophy. And our approach was to build on the foundation of private healthcare IT systems, but to compel those systems to work with each other, such that if a doctor on system A was working with a hospital on system B and seeing a patient who's insured by company Z, that those organizations could speak a common language, even if all of their back-end systems were effectively proprietary.
Healthcare today is based on a lot of goodwill by a lot of great physicians, but that's not sustainable. We need to start automating and creating processes and tools to not just be relying on the goodwill of a person.
Our view of it is that the AI is a means to an end, not the end in itself. The end is, what is the value we're trying to deliver to the hospital? And how can AI plus other approaches help us deliver that value?
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Welcome back. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS. Think back to the last time you needed to go to the doctor, whether it was an emergency or just a routine checkup. How was it? How was your experience? Unfortunately, the situation, it's also poor for clinicians, who are experiencing record levels of burnout, and they're rarely able to experience the joy of practicing medicine. Listen, we're in the midst of a profound transformation in the healthcare industry, driven by innovative companies leveraging cutting-edge technologies to transform the clinician to patient experience. And today, in this compilation episode, part four of our five-part health innovation series, we're going to learn about the remarkable work of CareJourney, ADOC, Forward, Clue, and TimeCare, who are redefining how we give and receive care. In case you missed the first three parts of this compilation series, make sure to check out our feed, where you'll find part one, which focused on innovations in drug R&D, part two on diagnostics and biomarkers, and part three on clinical trials. Each section will start with a brief introduction to the company, followed by an excerpt from their episode on the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you like what you hear and want to learn more about any of these companies, please check out our show notes for a link to the complete episodes. At Amazon, we're customer obsessed, so clinician to patient experience was always going to take a high spot in terms of my favorites for this compilation series, but enough from me, let's get started. My name is Alex Merwin from AWS, and on this episode, we'll dive into the cutting-edge work CareJourney is doing to integrate siloed healthcare data and provide actionable insights to drive value-based care. CareJourney is a healthcare analytics company that specializes in processing claims data from CMS, commercial payers, and others. So Anish, maybe you can just briefly introduce yourself and share what CareJourney does.
Thank you. I'm Anish Chopra. I'm the president and co-founder of CareJourney. We are an open data and analytics platform focused on building a trusted benchmark for the highest value doctors, hospitals, other facilities on the move to value-based care. We currently serve roughly 125 or so risk-bearing groups and health plans, and we're grateful for the opportunity to partner with AWS and to talk about some of the experiences on interoperability.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining. And Mirza, how about you? What is your background and role at AWS?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks, Alex. Yeah. I'm with a group called Health AI within AWS. And what Health AI does is basically build purposeful services for healthcare and life sciences. Been with AWS for over a year now. And my role essentially is to remove technical blockers and make it easier for customers to consume our services. My background prior to AWS, I was leading software development and enterprise data foundation for Envision Healthcare. I did a startup as well, co-founded and successfully exited as well. And I was the brand chief at the executive office of the president of the US, handling some technology related departments.
And Anish, we flew past your background, but you have some common threads there. Can you share a little bit about what you did?
Well,
for CareJourney?
I was giving a little bit of high-fiving to Mirza over the podcast, which is in the first term of the Obama administration, I was honored to serve as the nation's first chief technology officer, a role that reported directly to the president and was focused on making sure that technology, data, and innovation were applied effectively on the biggest challenges that confronted the country. And prior to that, I was Virginia's Secretary of Technology. And so this idea of public-private collaboration to unlock data, to make differences in people's lives. That's going to be a recurring theme we'll cover throughout this podcast.
Absolutely. And we work in healthcare because we want to make an impact. And the challenge is these are social goods funded by the public sector in many cases. But to drive the innovation, we need collaboration with the private sector. And we have a lot of people who listen to the podcast that either come at it from the investment angle, think venture capital, or from startups themselves. It's going to be a really good one. I'm excited. So without further ado, you know, Anish, can you start just by describing the new CMS interoperability and prior authorization rule and what it aims to accomplish?
Yeah. So this is the third chapter of a multi-chapter book. And so I'll go back to the first chapter and then I'll build up. In the United States, we felt that it was a public good to digitize the nation's health infrastructure. Many countries around the world have since shared that philosophy. And our approach was to build on the foundation of private healthcare IT systems, but to compel those systems to work with each other such that if a doctor on system A was working with a hospital on system B and seeing a patient who's insured by company Z, that those organizations could speak a common language, even if all of their back-end systems were effectively proprietary. Chapter one was to drive the adoption from paper to digital, and we've largely accomplished that goal in a relatively short period of time. Chapter two started to bring about the idea that we need to have a little bit more internet scale infrastructure facilitating the data sharing, not just for a human to see, but increasingly for applications that humans trust and use on their behalf. And so chapter two was largely around patient empowerment. So today, all government-sponsored health plans and all doctors and hospitals are fully capable of, for free, providing an API in a common language, which is in the US, we've built on the FHIR API, which is a global standard, a communication mechanism so that any patient with an app of their choice can understand their medications history, the history of conditions or services they've had, and some of the lab values that reflect their health status. We're entering now chapter three, and that chapter is to evolve what is essentially a consumer internet foundation towards more of a B2B foundation that reuses that same internet scale infrastructure and API foundation to foster data sharing between doctors and hospitals and labs and pharmaceutical companies and everybody else. So what you alluded to, Alex, and to get this conversation started, our U.S. regulator for health insurance, CMS, issued a final rule just a month or so from the recording of this podcast, January of 2024, calling for the creation of three business-to-business APIs off of that same foundation of what is shared with consumers. One, that they be used to reduce the friction of prior authorization. When a doctor wants to order a test or wants to administer a medication or provide a service, today insurance companies have some type of function where they review whether it's medically necessary to perform that service. And that process is manual, takes too long, patients get delayed in the care they deserve, and it overall frustrates everyone. That is now required to move to automation by 1/1/27. And the idea is that doctors can designate applications to understand the rules of an individual health plan's utilization management process. And conversely, doctors can share more detailed information about the patient that justified why they chose the course of action they've chosen with the plan to incorporate into their decision making. That API is currently in production at one or maybe a couple of sites, but it's to be scaled over the coming years. Second, a lot of individual consumers are switching health plans at the end of the year. While they've had the right to take their own data out of plan A and give it to plan B, this rule facilitates plans sharing it with each other because that type of handoff is critical for care coordination. So a B2B version of what the consumer can do is the second. They call that payer to payer. But this conversation is about the more exciting version, which is that doctors now have a right to get access to a patient's claims history so they have better situational awareness before that patient comes into their doors, or to ensure that they follow through on the treatment regimens the doctor prescribed and monitor whether, in fact, they've had those follow-on appointments. That functionality is called the Provider Access API. And what makes this interesting is it creates a very clear power dynamic shift. Today, you may request and a payer may respond, and it's an amorphous commitment on data sharing. Now, no choice. If the doctor is in a treatment relationship with a patient, the health plan must share. We're moving in towards a mandatory interoperability system, which is great for the American healthcare system and means better care coordination for our loved ones.
It's hugely exciting. And anybody who works in healthcare knows how broken it is, but we can become nihilistic and not see progress and name it for what it is. And this definitely is that. But Anish, can you bring this to life in terms of an example from the clinician's perspective? So can you think of a specialty, just make one up, of what, you know, what it would be like caring for a patient before the Provider Access API and what's going to be enabled once it's broadly adopted?
Let me start with the policy and empirical challenge. We have a healthcare system that is episodic. I've got back pain. I've got a concern that's very acute. I call a doctor to care for me in that circumstance. They treat me and I move on. But if I have an underlying chronic condition that may be the root cause of the problem, that may not have been relevant in the immediate treatment of a condition, but might have been more fundamental, that is often missed in our current healthcare system. So you might go to a cardiologist and they might be managing your heart health effectively. But if they were not aware of your other health status issues, maybe you've got an eye problem and you've got to go in for surgery, the understanding of your heart history's relevance to make sure that you are going to have a safe and effective surgery requires there to be some handoff and collaboration. That doesn't happen as often as it should. And so what the new model allows are for both sides of the previously fragmented system to learn a little bit more context and history about what was happening prior to the patient's arrival. Now, just to make it real, because you asked me to make it real for you, blood pressure control is probably one of the nation's biggest public health priorities. Less than half of the American people who've got elevated blood pressure are currently under control. And if we were able to put them under control, we could save in the United States well over 1 million heart attacks. The dynamic is, if I go to a specialist who's not thinking about my heart, because I see the cardiologist rarely, but I haven't been on my blood pressure meds as much as I should, and my health is deteriorating, but not to the point where I'm calling my cardiologist, I'm worried. If I go to see an ophthalmologist and now they're checking my blood pressure, or they can see in the data history that I've got this elevated hypertension, they can check it. And if there's a problem way before I have a heart attack or I, you know, need to go to the emergency room, they might call the cardiologist and say, hey, you might want to adjust the meds. Something's not working right. And by the way, these are like very cheap medications. So this is not even like an expensive service. But that handoff today doesn't occur, because that isn't the kind of information that would be naturally and readily available. So this is the hope, that not only will the individual doctors have access to information that we can use for situational awareness, but given that they have limited time and that may be an added burden that wasn't compensated, for lack of a better term, there's also the rise of these accountable care organizations that sit in between those two doctors that are employing nurses and care managers who can be that air traffic controller to track for all of this information and be that glue. So it doesn't put all the burden on an individual doctor to review, but potentially be a part of a team that has the right resources. And that's where Care Journey today spends most of its time, and why we're grateful in our AWS partnership that we can deliver at scale a relatively low cost service to ensure that care team has the information they need to coordinate and understand what's happened on a more time-sensitive basis.
So, how is AI transforming the way hospitals operate? Today, Guy Spiegelman, the EMEA lead for healthcare and life sciences startups at AWS, welcomes Elad Wallach, the founder and CEO of ADoc, to the show. ADoc offers a leading healthcare AI platform, which is used in over 1,000 medical centers globally, analyzing more than 1 million patients a month.
Welcome to the Health Innovation Podcast. I'm here with the CEO of ADoc, or AIDoc, Elad Wallach. Welcome. How are you doing today, Elad?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. And we accept all comers in terms of the name, but it's more ADoc because it's more about the aid than about the AI. How about that?
So, you know, I'm going to jump straight in because I've got like a list of pre-questions about the history of that, but let's just hone in on that point. Something I like to say is that I think the word digital health together sometimes does us less good than bad. And I prefer to talk about advancing healthcare, and then we're using digital tools to do that. What would you say?
No, I totally agree. I think that's one of the things we do the worst as an ecosystem. And we are overly focused on the tech versus the outcomes and value. And if you go to these conferences, there is an AI section. What is an AI section, right? Like, what's the value in an AI? And you bundle everything together, right? If you look at healthcare AI, as obviously my space, you have companies that do robotic process automation, finance, right? Companies like Cedar and Olive, great companies, right? Then you have companies in the documentation space. You have Epic doing better documentation. You have that with speech recognition. You have that. Then you have us, purely clinical diagnostics, FDA clearances, doing like care delivery. Those are very different spaces, and bundling everything under the box of, oh, we all use AI. It's almost, I think it's doing us as exactly right. It's a disservice. And I think it changes the conversation instead of talking about like value to how cool is this shiny toy. So I think we definitely need to change the conversation.
I think I 100% agree with you. And before we get further into our conversation, for the benefit of our listeners, perhaps you can give a sort of brief introduction to ADoc and what you guys are doing, what value you are bringing and have been bringing so far to the market.
Yes. So we are, as mentioned, strictly in this clinical AI box. And effectively what we help health systems is to identify clinical insights and then carry them to the relevant physician. I'll give a quick example. One of our earlier products were for radiology for triaging patients. So let's say you have 100 patients in the ED. They all go through a CT scan with a headache. But maybe patient 100 that should be waiting a couple of hours is actually the patient with a severe brain bleed or a stroke. Our AI allows to automatically run on every patient on the images and say, oh, actually patient number 100 that would have waited for a couple of hours has something urgent. Let's bump it to the top. Or by the way, sometimes even let's notify the surgical team, right? Maybe he needs to be evaluated by a specialist. So all of the things, it's about identification of clinical signals and then notification to a physician somewhere in the health.
So you said that was one of your earlier products, right? Tell me about how long it took you since developing that product to actually seeing it installed for the first time and helping patients' lives.
So at first, it was a long time, right? It took about 2 years, I would say, because we had to develop it. We had to go through FDA, and then you'd have to go through installation and BAA and security reviews and agreements. You all know that takes forever. So it took 2 years. But I will say now we're much more advanced than that. It's probably one of the most widely distributed clinical AI solutions. And we're at this point analyzing over 2, almost 3 million patients a month. It took us a while to get to the first one, but now we see it's really that's in the trajectory of really reaching significant scale.
Yeah. I think if I had to make an analogy, what you said before about not focusing on the technology and the value, you've been able to show a lot of value to patients, to clinicians, but who do you see as your customer? Do you see the clinician as your customer, the hospital manager as your customer? That's interesting for me because there's the technology and the product side, but like, how do you actually into use?
It's such a good question. And by the way, I would have answered it differently 2 years ago versus now.
Wow. Okay.
So It's both because of our evolution and the market evolution. So 2 years ago, we were mainly selling to clinicians. Radiologists was originally the first audience. And really, we were like targeting them, chair of a radiology department. That was the role. But over time, what happened in the health system market, and everybody in healthcare, I think we see the apocalypse or the Armageddon that has happened over the past 2 years. And two things that happened at the same time. A, the decision-making escalated to hire to more senior people, especially for significant IT spend. And this stems from the fact that every hospital need to cut cost, and they had to rationalize how many different IT solutions they use. So that really elevated the conversation. So a lot of budget conversations are now happening in the executive suite. That was coupled by the fact that we really evolved as a company to an enterprise platform. So we now have solutions for radiology, of course, but cardiology, neurology, ED, critical care, population health. So now the decision-making also makes sense from an enterprise perspective.
Let me just like frame this for the audience, because I know a bit of your history, but you started in very much radiology, medical, sort of artificial intelligence for medical imaging. And your evolution has gone, is it still heavily imaging focused?
Still a lot of our products are there, but many are not. Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about something that's not imaging focused.
Yeah. So when we started ADOC, it was the value proposition for AI in clinical care is obvious, right? Everybody, we all know that 10 years from now, it's going to be ubiquitous, right? But we try to understand why isn't this really deployed widely, right? It was 5 years ago when we, 5-6 years ago when we started, it was mind-boggling, right? And in our opinion, the biggest issue was the fragmentation of solutions. And it's not unique to AI, by the way. It's for a lot of healthcare tech, you see fragmentation. EHR in the early days, right? Departmental EHRs, telehealth per disease. And with AI, it was even worse because AI solutions are like literally per disease state. So you have a stroke AI solution, a lung cancer solution. So a radiologist could have 5,000 different AI products, like literally. And what we said is, how about we change the consumption model a bit, figure out a way to scale AI in a different way? So our whole spiel as a company, like ADOC's claim to fame, is really the enterprise platform, right? We try to grow the solution suite and become both a comprehensive developer of AI, but also someone that can integrate third parties. So when we partner with a health system, it's a one-stop shop for AI.
Okay, but then that also then, in terms of how that positions you, that then starts to position you against some pretty major players.
Well, look, I think that's what's needed for the market. And I think we have to grow to that because I think that is the solution the market needs. The market needs a holistic, systematic way to consume AI, clinical AI.
Okay. Great. So look, maybe just understanding now how your product has evolved, how have you developed as a company, both geography-wise, but also in terms of growing your people and culture? This is a health innovation podcast. So yes, we want to focus on the health side, but also your innovation journey and how you've scaled as a company. How do you manage also as a founder? How have you coped personally on this journey?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. We are 400 to 500 people at this point. So just to give a where we are in the journey. And I think the biggest shift for us was from a company who developed a single service line, right, or a single product line to multiple, and that shift to the enterprise. That is such a massive change because you might think it's a big deal. You're selling to radiologists, now you're selling to cardiologists, neurologists. Oh my God. It's such a different game. They go to different conferences, they speak different language, and to be able to work with all these different specialties at the same time is extremely difficult. So the big cultural shift we had to do is work from everybody's like laser focused on one service line, like working together and everybody knows everything, to much more of a team play. Now there is nobody that knows everything, right? I cannot speak as intelligent to all these physician types, it's impossible to contain all that knowledge. So now it's much more of a team game and it's much more of a team sale. It's much more of a team development process. So how do we maintain the same agility and depth, but like now working really cross-functionally, even within ADOC? So the whole coordination problem we see in healthcare, we actually sometimes have internally. And that is some of the battles that we're having. And we're starting to ingrain into our culture a lot of these like new modes of much more teaming, much more collaborative, much more challenging one another. I think those are some of the aspects that I find really interesting in the evolution.
Today, I'm joined by Adrian Ayoun from Forward Health, who's on a mission to create a healthcare system that could reach 1 billion people across the world. Now, that's a lofty vision, so they're getting started by transforming how primary care is delivered. And I love this conversation for the out-of-the-box ideas and ambition that Adrian and his team have. I hope you really enjoy it. Here we go. Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, Adrian Ayoun. It's such a pleasure to meet you. I've been really looking forward to this one. You can tell me a little bit about what y'all do at Forward.
Yeah, so Forward started with a pretty simple premise, right? We looked around and we said, there's about 8 billion people on the planet, yet for some odd reason, less than 2 billion of them have access to any form of real healthcare, anything you and I would call real healthcare. And so I was like, wait a minute, like in the year 2023, like how's this possible? We all have cell phones, we're on the cusp of self-driving cars, yet we can't get basic healthcare out to the planet. If you take a step back and you almost ask yourself why, it's like healthcare is roughly based on doctors. So imagine I walked up to you and I said, I want to get doctors to the whole planet, to billions of people, to the middle of India, the middle of Rwanda, to everyone. You'd say, Adrian, where the hell are you going to get all these doctors and who the hell is going to pay for them? But if I walked up to you and I said, I want to get smartphones to the whole planet, to the middle of India, the middle of Rwanda, to billions of people, you're going to say, Adrian, not only do I think it's possible, I think you're a little late to the game. What do you intuitively know? We intuitively know humans don't scale in a way that technology does. Or another way to say it is doctors don't scale in a way that hardware and software does. So at Forward, we have this key insight, which is that actually we're doing it all wrong. Healthcare should be a product, not a service. We should just take every single thing that doctors and nurses are doing and just migrate it over to hardware and software. Because if we do, we know that we can scale healthcare up to billions and billions of people. And so that's our mission. Our mission at Forward is really simple. We want to create the first at-scale healthcare system, the first healthcare system to truly scale to planet scale. Or another way to say it is the first healthcare system to truly scale to 1 billion users. That's what we're trying to do over here.
Well, I love big visions, and that definitely is one. I've got some follow-up questions for you, but we will work our way into it step by step. But let's learn a little bit more about you. What brought you to Forward?
Look, my background is not in the world of healthcare. I'm your standard tech nerd. I just don't have the pocket protector and the big thick glasses, but I'm sure they'll issue them soon. So I started a company in the AI space a bunch of years ago. It was basically teaching computers to read and understand language. Think of it as like Siri on your phone, that sort of stuff. This was before AI was like all hot like it is now. What happened was Google acquired that company. I went and helped build a bunch of the AI sort of efforts over at Google. Did that for a little. But then interestingly, our CEO at the time was still Larry Page, who's still running the place. And he asked me to switch gears and come start working for him. So I spent the next few years, actually as Larry's kind of right-hand man, helped create Alphabet, create a bunch of the Alphabet companies, et cetera. Now, I was a kid in a candy store. I started companies like Sidewalk Labs, literally working on creating full-scale cities from scratch. I worked on all sorts of projects. And you're thinking, why the hell would you ever leave that? But I had the unfortunate experience, which is my older brother who lives out in New York had a heart attack. And I kind of watched what he went through. And it's the same story that happens to all of us, right? Where you don't really think about healthcare. You're like, sure, whatever I hear is crap, but it's probably fine. It's probably good enough until you're the one who goes through it. And you're like, Jesus Christ, healthcare's experience is awful. So folks like you and I, we all have access to great care. We never even go to the doctor, right? Because who the hell wants to go when the experience is that bad? Turns out if you don't go, they can't help you. I saw the healthcare super reactive. Everybody's by my brother's side after the heart attack. I was just thinking, dude, I need you. I needed one of you like a year ago. I also saw, and this one's on us as engineers, is we haven't set doctors up for success. Like you wouldn't go up to a software engineer and ask them to build you a website, but not hand them a laptop, which is like the sum culmination of all human advancement in this beautiful 2-pound device. But for some reason, it's totally okay to go up to a doctor and say, save my life. And you start by handing them a stethoscope, like a hollow tube invented in the 1800s. Are you kidding me right now? You know, when you were a kid and you wanted to hear what your parents were saying in the other room and you, like, you took a glass up to the door. Turns out that's what a stethoscope is. That's how we're saving lives in the year 2023. I was like, this is appalling. We have to do better. And the last thing I saw is what I mentioned earlier. that healthcare is prohibitively expensive. And there's billions that we could complain all we want, the crap that we have, but there's billions of people who don't even have the crap that we have. And I said, look, this has to be rethought. We have to go back to first principles and ask, how can we do this better? We want to truly solve this problem once and for all.
When we engage with the healthcare system, there are a few things that can make us feel as small as when we are truly sick and helpless. I get what you're saying about technology, but oh man, when I'm really frustrated or I'm really scared and I talk to Siri, she lets me down every single time. Now, I don't know, maybe LLMs are going to get so good where Siri A actually knows what I'm saying, but B could meet me where I'm at as a really vulnerable and sick human, but we're definitely not there. So what's the role for empathy in providing care? And how do you see technology fitting in with that?
It's funny how your brain immediately went to technology reduces empathy, technology reduces relationships. Let me push on that. Because whenever I'm having a tough moment, the first thing I do is I pull out my iPhone and I FaceTime my best friend or I call my cousin, right? And actually, the best technologies allow us to be more human. The best technologies allow us to connect in even deeper ways, right? It turns out that what you identified, let's call it Siri, it's just crap. Let's be real, it's a piece of junk, right? But now ask yourself this. The last time you went through a terrible breakup, you're on the floor crying, you have your heart broken. What do? Honestly, you reach for your phone and like you call your best friend, you call your mother, your cousin, your children, I don't know, your spouse, whoever it is, right? Like you call the people that you need. You're not shouting across the country. You're picking up an iPhone, which again is like the sum culmination of all human advancement in this 4-inch wide piece of glass in your pocket. Let's say you're just having a really bad day. You're part of some layoffs at work. Again, what do? You're not calling a doctor. You're calling your support network. Let's say you log into your Schwab account one day and the markets have crashed and you lost 90% of your money. What do? Again, you lean on your support network, right? And so what we've done in the world of healthcare that's incredibly odd is we've taken the service, kind of the product that we get, and we've combined that with the empathy. And I think that's actually kind of odd way to think about it, right? It's like, why am I not getting that empathy almost different from a different place than where I'm getting that service? Yeah, I might need surgery. Yeah, I might have cancer. Those are awful things. Like, those are terrible. I'm not saying you don't need humans to help you. Of course, we're tribe animals, right? We're pack animals. Like, we want relationships with humans. But I don't think that it has to be the $250,000 a year person in front of you that's doing the surgery to be the person to give you that empathy and that support.
That's a really good point. And also, technology is an enabler. So it's not about technology reducing the need for empathy. In fact, it's a force multiplier because you can remove a lot of the clutter and the busy work and hopefully create more space and more time for a provider to really have that connection.
Yeah. And you see this, we all love to shit on the social networks, but in essence, the social networks have brought us much closer together. By that, there's one of my closest friends from high school. Let's be real. I don't talk to you that often, but I know everything that's going on in his life and he knows everything that's going on in my life. And that's awesome. That's the power of technology. Absolutely brings us together. If you don't believe me, just ask yourself, if you lived 150 years ago on the farm with no phone, do you think you were closer to everybody around the country and around the world? No, of course not. That's an absurd concept. And so there's zero question that technology has its pros and its cons, but without doubt, it has brought us closer together.
So what were the biggest surprises you encountered when you got involved in healthcare? Because you worked in some very different spaces before. You've entered with this big and bold vision. What surprised you?
I'm going to sound incredibly obnoxious and say actually not that much. And I'll tell you why. Most people that want to go after an industry spend their time learning the industry. I don't know about healthcare. I really don't. I am not a healthcare person. Instead, I just try to go back to first principles and understand the problems that we need to solve. And it turns out that any one of us, we have our lived experience. We have our lives. We've been sick. We've been healthy. We know that we're aging. We know that we're going to die. We are actually all experts in what healthcare should look like. I promise you. Does that mean that we understand how insurance and payers and what all these, acts of Congress mean? Do we know Medicare and Medicaid? No, but you don't need to. Those aren't the things that matter. The same way, it's not like you were sitting over in the early days of Google, sitting there trying to explain to Larry and Sergey the Dewey Decimal System. Like, we're not trying to rebuild a library. We're trying to build Google. And so instead, once you start with first principles, it turns out you end up not being surprised that often. Yeah, it's an industry with a lot of regulation. Yeah, it's an industry where you really do have to rebuild a whole bunch of infrastructure from the ground up. So I know it's a lot of work. And I'm not saying by any stretch that I think we have a guaranteed chance of success. No, I think it's incredibly low probability that we accomplish our mission. But I also know that the strategy we're going about is the right strategy because, again, you can clearly determine this from first principles, and that's what matters.
So tell me more about those first principles.
So whenever I want to think about what's the future of an industry, I just start by doing the thought experiment. I don't know if you've done thought experiments before, but they're really easy. If choose a dimension, you take it to the extreme. Let's try an example, right? So healthcare today, about 20% of GDP, which really just means 20% of your paycheck, going up a lot, right? It's going up about 7% year over year. Doesn't sound like much until you realize that means doubling every decade. Like somehow this thing's going to be 40% of my paycheck in a decade. I don't even know how you do that. But rather than thinking about the 20% and the 40%, just ask yourself the thought experiment. Do I believe at the limit healthcare should cost $1 a person or $1 billion a person? And I think we're all going to agree. Healthcare is going to cost $1 a person. Okay, great. So that's the first thing. We know at Ford that we want to reduce costs. Okay, second thing. Do I believe that I'm better off reacting to medical issues or preventing medical issues? At the limit, do I want to build only prevention or do I want to build only reaction? Obviously, prevention. This is incredibly obvious, right? What is it? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure? Like, it turns out these things are very logical. Okay, so now we know that we want it to cost $1 a person and we want it to be preventive. Okay, next thing. Do we believe that healthcare at the limit should use one piece of data or all the data? Obviously, all the data. More knowledge can't hurt you, right? So all the information. So we know at Ford that every single day we are going to be striving to collect more and more information. But let's keep going. Do I believe that to practice medicine, to help others, you need to go to 100 years of med school, or that the tools are so simple that you can practice medicine with 5 minutes of knowledge? Well, why not 5 minutes? So we know that at Ford, every single day, we should be creating tools that make it easier and easier for us to provide care for anyone to provide care for someone else. Let's keep going. Do we believe that healthcare should be gated behind other people, right? Doctors, nurses, insurance companies, et cetera? Or do we believe that the tools should be so great that you can take control of your own health, that you can determine your own health and make your own decisions? Obviously, we believe the power should be put in your hands. So every day, what we're doing is we're working to create tools that allow our members to control their own future of their health, not leave it in anybody else's hands. And I can keep going. These are merely a few, maybe 4 or 5 of the dimensions that we think about, whereas we think about 30, we think about 40 dimensions. But at the end of the day, what you quickly realize is that the future of healthcare becomes incredibly obvious once you just sit down and ask yourself from first principles, where should it go?
Imagine a world where ICU teams can predict life-threatening events hours before they happen. Today, we welcome Clue to the pod, who offers a clinical command center that applies AI to enable earlier interventions, improving patient and business outcomes for hospitals. All right, Paul Rusko, the CEO of Clue Medical, welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. I'm really excited for you to be here today.
Thank you, Alex. Good to be here.
All right, Paul, so where are you joining us from?
I am in Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay, and your accent betrays you. Where are you from originally, and when did you move to Boston?
Yes, obviously I need to get some more elocution lessons done, but I am originally from Manchester, England, and I have been over here in the US for about 22 years now.
Oh, great. You and I changed places. I used to live in the US and I moved to London in 2015, but we are not here today to talk about what side of the pond we're on. We're here to talk about Clue Medical. Maybe we can start off and you can tell me more about Clue Medical and what exactly you do. So what problem do you solve?
Yeah, the problem we solve is one that's faced by hospitals across the world, not just a US problem. And that is that there are patients inside hospitals in beds that are high risk patients or becoming high risk, what's called emerging risk or rising risk patients, that if we can provide a way of identifying those patients before they actually deteriorate, before they create the risk, and getting that notification to a clinician so that they can drive an earlier intervention, good things will happen all around. Better patient outcomes for the patient and for the caregiver, and also a good business decision for the hospital in terms of being able to reduce costs, improve throughput, and allow their fundamental mission, which is to deliver better patient care. So Clue has provided what we call an intelligent clinical surveillance platform. Think of it almost as a sort of clinical command center. We look across the hospital, we capture rich physiological data about a patient, and we identify which patients should be prioritized for an intervention. We can do that in a few different ways. But fundamentally, by driving an earlier intervention, we provide better patient outcomes and better business outcomes for the hospital.
Can you tell me a little bit about the types of data that you consume in order to make those predictions?
Yes, a part of our prowess is the ability to bring in data from a variety of different sources. Our goal at the end of the day is to build this, what we call a rich physiological profile on the patient. And we use the electronic medical record that provides us access to ADT and labs and vitals and medications data. We interface to the monitoring equipment at the bedside that provides us with access to a very high frequency of data. So it's not uncommon for us to be capturing data on a patient every 30 seconds, every minute. And then we scrub that data, clean it, tag it, and use that data to identify which patients we think require prioritization and which patients require an intervention. And one of the things that's somewhat unique to Clue is that we have received an FDA clearance. We're classed as a medical device for some of the predictions that we're able to provide to a caregiver. So we have what we call high-risk predictions, where our AI-based machine learning and data science prowess allows us to build these models that will predict a patient's likely to deteriorate at some point in the next 6 to 8 hours, far in advance, perhaps, of what their clinical data might be suggesting at that point in time. We can identify that Paul Roscoe is going to have a respiratory failure in 4 hours and surface that to the caregiver for them to drive a different type of intervention than they might have done otherwise.
So I want to come back to that. It'd be great to learn a little bit about the evidence generation journey, what that FDA submission process was like. But before we go there, I want to learn a little bit more about you, Paul. So you've had a very rich career journey from being the general manager of Microsoft's Healthcare Solutions Group. You've held executive positions at Trenda Health, Docent Health, Crimson, and others. Can you speak to Clue's founding principles? And I'd like to learn what drew you to this business. What drew you to join the team as CEO?
I've been in healthcare my whole life. I started actually as an accountant in the British National Health Service in the way back. My mother is a nurse or was a nurse. My sister was a nursing executive. So healthcare has always been part of my life. And in the early days, I realized that I wanted to be with companies that had a very direct association with driving a better outcome for a patient. We've all been with companies, I'm sure, where it's a little abstract. It's difficult to understand what you're doing day to day or what you're doing to lead a company in terms of what impact it's having. So I've always tried to position myself with companies that was very direct in terms of the positive benefits that technology can bring to a patient. Because at the end of the day, they're at the most vulnerable periods of time, and that's when they need the most support. And really, that's what led me to Clue, is that connection. At the end of the day, if Clue's solutions are operating effectively, patients are going to have a different outcome. Their future outcome is going to be positively impacted by Clue identifying that they potentially are at risk for an infection and driving a better intervention. And that's really palpable. And I think that's the sort of energy that you see inside of Clue. It's the mission that has attracted a lot of great talent to the company, has been this direct association between providing assistance to the caregiver. Again, I stress this all the time. We're not there from an AI perspective or from a technology to replace a clinician. We're there to try and help and augment, then provide a better environment and a better outcome for the patient. And that's very direct with Clue.
Let's go back to the FDA submission. And I wanted to speak with you about Clue's regulatory strategy. This is a very challenging problem for any entrepreneur to solve on their journey.
And can you tell me a little bit about the evidence generation journey that Clue underwent and how the regulatory submissions worked, how you worked with the agency, and just with an eye for giving advice to other founders that are looking to deploy AI into clinical work?
I think you're absolutely right that it is a challenging journey. And part of the journey, part of the challenge is to decide to embark on the regulatory journey in the first place. And you've seen, I think particularly in the US, many claims that are being made by clinical AI companies that are frankly just that. They're the vendor's own claims. And we've seen many examples of when they've made those claims around clinical predictions not being fulfilled. So for us, we always felt that for us to be successful, the regulatory oversight wasn't a hurdle. It was just going to be something that was really important for us to be able to establish the credibility of our approach. And doing that in front of the FDA is important. And that then helps build confidence and trust, we believe, by our customers. And so to embark on that particular journey required us initially to partner with healthcare organizations that were able to provide us with rich data sets for which we could build and train these models that we built to identify what were the predictions, what were the clinical targets that we thought were the most impactful and powerful, and the ones that the data would allow us to predict. And for us, we chose three predictive models that we wanted to go through a regulatory approach. Two high-risk models. One of them is a predicting hemodynamic instability. Another one is predicting a patient having a respiratory failure event that might require them to be put on a ventilator. And probably actually as important is a low-risk model, which are these patients are stable and actually will be stable over the next 8 to 12 hours. So you don't necessarily need to prioritize them from a care perspective. And our process was then to identify sites inside the US where we could get access to large amounts of data to train the models. And we were able to work with some great healthcare institutions in the US that would give us access to that data. And then through a set of iteration, we would take data from one particular population area in the US and then take it into another area that might have a different demographic, test it and tune it for that particular population. We did this pre-COVID. And then we went back with the models that we were building post-COVID to make sure that if there were any differences physiologically in the COVID, post-COVID population, we were accommodating them in our models. And we found that there was definitely customizations we had to make. We would look at the data to see if there were any biases that were being built and try and adjust appropriately. And that process was done in conjunction with the conversations we were having with the FDA and the process we were going through the FDA. And I think fast forward now with the FDA clearance that we've received, we built a lot of prowess about how to work through a FDA pipeline. And we're actually submitting some new models now for the FDA to start to give us their opinion on.
So how do you think about new customer acquisition and prioritizing your targets? The easy answer is every startup wants to work with every potential customer, but then you get into it and this is pretty hands-on. You're deploying into the ICU. So, you know, there's probably some customers that perhaps they're less appealing from a top-line revenue perspective, but they're going to work with you more on providing the data you need to support this pipeline of future submissions to the FDA, which ostensibly increases your portfolio of adverse events that you can predict, which strengthens the value proposition of the overall offering. So how do you balance those two things? Because you need to keep the lights on. You last raised institutional funding in 2020, I believe. Mm-hmm. You can correct me there. So how do you think about that?
One of the first things that I did when I joined Clue about a year ago was look at the sort of core DNA of what the company has been able to achieve in the tele-ICU space. And it was a quick realization to me that what we actually have built here has broad applicability, not just in the tele-ICU world, but across the whole enterprise of the hospital. These high-risk and emerging risk patients don't just exist inside the ICU. They exist in ED. They exist in the PACU after they've come out of a OR. They exist down on the med-surg floors. And so we embarked on a product strategy to extend and expand our platform to have broad surveillance capability, not just for the ICU population. And that was important actually also for the health system, because you think about it, the ICU represents 10-15% of the patient population. And there are, patients outside the ICU in these other care venues that require more optimized interventions. And so it fit well. It wasn't just we'd like to do this outside the ICU. It was a problem that we were hearing from our prospective customers. And so fast forward today, we've got this broader platform that is applicable to pretty much any patient inside the hospital. And over time, this is a future, but over time for patients that are at home, hospitals are embarking on hospital at home strategies, and that will require a sophisticated technology surveillance approach to monitor those patients when they're not in the hospital setting. With that backdrop, that allows us to then say, who's a good fit for Clue? And we approach the market in two different ways. One is a direct sales approach, where we are working with the larger health systems that might be integrated delivery networks with multiple hospitals or academic medical institutions. And the more patients you basically throw at Clue, the better value and ROI you get. And then we have, you might think of it as a channel. So these are technology, these are physician or clinician service companies that are providing outsourced clinical services to a hospital. And they employ physicians, they employ nurses, and contract with hospitals to provide outsourced tele-ICU or outsourced virtual nursing. And those companies typically have used the hospital's technology stack when they go about their job, and they realize that didn't scale very well. So they'd come to Clue, and they bring the Clue technology along with their people, and they offer it as a sort of package solution. A good example of that is a relationship we have with a company called Ecume Medical, who have a large bank of clinicians, physicians, nurses, and they work in conjunction with Clue to deliver a complete managed clinical service.
Have you ever wondered how technology and compassion can come together to transform cancer care? Today, we welcome Robin Shaw, the co-founder and CEO of TimeCare, to the show, a company that collaborates across the cancer care community to improve access, experience, and outcomes, all while lowering the total cost of care.
Well, I'm very excited to welcome Robin Shaw, the co-founder and CEO of TimeCare, and Finn, his trusted assistant, to the podcast today. Welcome to both of you.
Yeah, no, thank you, Alice. Thanks for having me on this podcast. So I have been working in the oncology marketplace for nearly 15 years. And I started my career actually working in an oncology practice. My father is a medical oncologist. My little brother is a medical oncologist. My older brother works in oncology. And so when I started working with my father in 2007, started to learn about a lot of the things that oncology practices and the oncology ecosystem needed from a problem-solving perspective. That actually led me to Nat Turner. I met Nat Turner and Zach Weinberg. They started a company prior to Flatiron called Invite Media, but were tech entrepreneurs in the ecosystem and were starting an oncology startup in 2012. And I met them very early on in that journey and decided we had very like minds and wanted to solve similar problems. So joined Nat and Zach 2012, really early at Flatiron Health, and ended up spending 5 years at the organization, saw the company through its exit. But about a year before the company exited, realized that there was an opportunity to partner and build something with some of the greatest oncology practices in the country. And so launched a new company alongside a number of great leaders called One Oncology. That's actually where I met Finn's mother, who worked with me at One Oncology from 2018 until 2020, when we started TimeCare. And the reason we started TimeCare was, given this was One Oncology, was my third stint in the oncology space, I started to get a lot of phone calls from people all across the country saying, Robin, we know you've been working in oncology or cancer for 10 plus years. We know someone, or me or my friend or my colleague, has been diagnosed with cancer. They don't know what to do. They're struggling. Would you be willing to talk to them or talk to me? And I ended up turning into a navigator. And on a biweekly basis, someone across the country was calling me and asking me for help. And in 2020, I called a number of my former Flatiron colleagues, and most specifically, co-founder and chief medical officer, Dr. Bobby Green. And I said, we've got to solve for this problem. I'm sure you experienced the same phone calls. And so in 2020, we set off on a journey to build a company to try to help people who are navigating through a cancer diagnosis. And we didn't know much about the space. We just knew what we wanted to help people. And that was really what TimeCare was born out of.
And did you say June or January 2020?
We started incubating the company and the concept in early 2020. The company officially launched in July of 2020.
Mm-hmm. The people who work in this industry are doing it to make an impact. I left advertising technology to join health innovation because I wanted my career to have greater social impact and help improve people's lives. But it's interesting to hear your story. You've been in the space for 10 years. And I get it. At the end of the day, someone calls and, Robin, I'm scared. I got this diagnosis. I don't know what to do. You're the person I know who works in this space. What can you do to help? And really, real world data and next gen therapeutics and these things, they matter from a population health perspective, but that doesn't really help you in that situation. And so I definitely get the drive. What was it like starting this company in the middle of the pandemic?
Yeah. So a little backstory. I actually just got married too.
Haven't you heard this thing? Don't do more than one life-changing event at a single time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You ignored it. It's a chance to look up. Actually, Finn's mother helped plan my wedding as I did a surprise wedding where I surprised my wife that on the day of our engagement that we were getting married a few hours later. And I told Finn's mother, her name is Ginny, I'm going to need your help to plan this out. And we did an awesome event with 150 people here in Nashville. But shortly after that, we got hit with COVID and we were all locked down. And I was still, you know, full-time working at One Oncology. Our organization at One Oncology did not lock down the same way as other businesses, meaning I was still on the road on a routine basis. But the world had shifted to the openness of virtual meetings, which changed a lot of the dynamic for someone like myself in regards to time. And I ended up finding myself thinking about this problem, parsing through a bunch of data that I was given from health plans or health insurance companies, and started to realize in the summer of 2020 that this problem that we wanted to solve for was actually a problem that health insurance companies and oncology practices experience. And we started to really noodle on this idea of, if we want to help people and we want to build a business, how do we deal where everyone wins in this scenario? And because we were virtual, we had the ability to iterate and move quickly and do things at odd times during the day and during the weekends as we were incubating and all working in different organizations. And as we started to present this thesis to a potential partner or client, and they said, yeah, this makes sense, we quickly got investors excited about what we're doing and all started to mobilize towards this idea or concept.
And have you retained that remote or hybrid first culture with how you operate today? How are you currently structured?
Yeah, we call it hybrid first, which means we have two offices. We have one in Nashville, which we're sitting in today. We have one in New York City, which is in Soho. And every single person that joins TimeCare gets a remote workstation. So they get a stipend to build up, buy a nice camera, get a desk, get a standing desk, get a nice chair. And you have the option on a daily basis to either come into one of our locations or work remotely. And so right now, we're about 140 to 150 people in the company. I would say on a daily basis, they're on average maybe 10 to 15 people in the Nashville office and half that in the New York office. But we try to get together on a routine basis, maybe every quarter or every 6 months as a company and or a leadership team. But a lot of times you'll see four meeting rooms here filled up with people that are Zooming to each other because there are four remote people and they want to make sure that they don't experience that interaction differently. And so we're very thoughtful about how people interact to make sure we're effective for folks that may be remote or may not be able to access an office.
So beyond that norm of laptops open when we're in the room together, and maybe we're not in the room together, so there's not the meeting after the meeting, right?
Yeah.
Say following that. But what other things have you learned? Either things that have worked really well, things that didn't, as you've been iterating and trying different modalities of work?
So number one, I would say the thing that has unlocked our ability to grow so quickly is we can capture talent all across the country. We've got people in 20-ish states, and we've set it up so that there isn't glitches in the technology. Everyone gets a stipend for a dedicated Wi-Fi network for time care work. They're not sharing Wi-Fi with a partner or a colleague or anyone else within their home. They have the ability to just focus on their work at time care. I would say the second thing is we've created this normalcy around building your own schedule and being mindful of what your schedule is. And some people wake up early. That's when they operate. A lot of people at time care have children. And like myself, I have limited availability from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. because I'm with my 2.5 or 3-year-old. But I'm available after that. And so the norm is respect people's boundaries, but ultimately be available to be able to do your job when you need to. That's one of the critical things in regards to this working environment. I would say the second thing is we've created this culture where if you want to come in person, you have the ability to do that. As well as if you're remote, you have the ability to come to one of our offices. And we've set up an experience where if you want to do that or bring your team in to do that, where we're very open to it and there's access to that in the company.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast for part 4 of our 5-part miniseries focused on health innovation. Next week, in our final episode of this miniseries, we'll dive deep into the world of real-world evidence, data, and population health. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss our latest episodes. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.